Hi everyone, I'm Gary Naughton. I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, I'll be continuing with the ongoing, in-depth, original investigative reporting series, Intervention, in the name of Peace, Freedom, and Democracy. This is part four of what I anticipate to be a five-part series. Up to this point, I have explored various parts of the world in which we have intervened. Here is the issue. The average American, when they look in a newspaper, watch television, listen to radio, they are informed that there is a need for us to go into a particular place in the world. Maybe it's Haiti, Dominican Republic, maybe it's Nicaragua, or Salvador, Nigeria, or Iraq, Afghanistan. Virtually throughout our history, we've been told that the reason that we are doing this is not to nation build, not to in any way exploit the natural resources, not to have some form of geopolitical advantage in that area, not to expand our military bases, but rather because the people need us. We are there to support the average person. However, when you take the time to do a methodical and scholarly look at the actual facts, the real history, you see that is not the case. I am surprised that the American media, by and large, with some exceptions such as Covert Action Quarterly, The Nation, The Village Voice, many of the progressive publications, The New Republic and others, they have at least been willing to look at the truth of what happens in a country. They have dialogue with individuals from those countries. And they have a completely different point of view. When I travel to South America, Central America, when I travel to Europe or other countries, I am always reminded that the view of what happens in their country is completely different by the people in the country versus what Americans are told they should realize about a country. That is why I believe this series is so important. And in this particular environment, both Democrats and Republicans, it was virtually unanimous, with only a few dissenting voices, less than six, who said we should not have been in Iraq and actively pursued not being there. Even at this point, a year ago when Jack Murtha, the Democrat, challenged the idea of us being in Iraq, he originally supported us being there. Why can't we have people who from the get-go see that our intents, our purposes, our real motives for being in a country is not to bring freedom, peace, or democracy, but there's another agenda? And yet there were 15 million Americans and people throughout the world combined, 15 million throughout the world, who protested prior to going into Iraq. None of them were given credibility. In fact, they were attacked as being defeatist, anti-American, non-patriotic. At the end of the day, the 15 million were correct. And all of the so-called best and brightest from the think tanks and the major news media, the Judith Millers of the New York Times, and the Hannity and Bill O'Reilly's and all the others who beat the drums for war, who said it was necessary to protect us being there. I could show you people like them, of their reputation and their prestige in the media, influencing public opinion going back several hundred years. Let us give you an example of that, of how many conflicts did not have to exist, but inappropriate decisions made it so. Let's take a look at Vietnam. Beginning in 1950, North Vietnam began to concern the U.S. government because of its communist leader, Ho Chi Minh. The U.S. denied aid to Ho Chi Minh, despite the fact, and here's what people may not be aware of, that Ho Chi Minh contacted President Truman and asked for help in gaining independence from the French colonists. In fact, Ho Chi Minh had been on America's side during the Second World War, and the U.S. ended up taking sides with the French against Ho Chi Minh. By the way, let us not forget that the French also had been, many of them, friends with the Japanese during the World War II. Author William Blum writes, Ho Chi Minh modeled the new Vietnamese Declaration of Independence on the American Declaration of Independence, beginning with, quote, all men are created equal. They are endowed by their creator with, well, this would count for nothing in Washington that Ho Chi Minh was trying to formulate a concept of rights in Vietnam similar to those in the United States. In the minds of people in Washington, he was a communist, plain and simple. It was black and white, and he was on the black side of this equation. In the 4 years between 1954 and 1958, America's secret operatives made a concerted effort to overthrow Ho Chi Minh. In the South, other secret American forces helped locate and destroy Viet Cong operatives working within the countryside communities. This project was dubbed Operation Phoenix, and they murdered approximately 20,000 people. As the war continued on through the 60s and the mid-70s, the environmental damage by our weapons, the death toll not only from our efforts in Vietnam but in other parts of Asia as well, all in the name of stemming communism, gave the beleaguered people of Vietnam an underdog status in the eyes of the rest of the world. In 1975, the North Vietnamese broke through the South Vietnamese line and took Saigon. Saigon was retitled Ho Chi Minh City. Throughout the war, the death estimates range from a low of 1 million to as high as 4 million Vietnamese people. Over a million military were killed and over a half a million wounded. That does not include the civilians, who in all wars are the largest casualty numbers. And for the United States alone, approximately 56,000 soldiers were killed, 350,000 wounded, and not to mention the stigma that they carried when they came back to the United States, social isolation, anger towards them. Now, here is the issue. Today, many people are using Vietnam as an analogy, some to support the idea that we should stay the course, some stating that had we only given Westmoreland more troops, had we only done more bombing, that we would not have had the communists take over South Vietnam. The reality is that more troops and more bombs would not have defeated Ho Chi Minh. They were fighting for a cause greater than ours. They were fighting for their country. They were fighting because they had been under colonial rule for decades. They wanted to be our friends. We chose to reject that friendship. They wanted to cooperate with us. We chose to reject their cooperation. So as a result, millions of people suffered and died, hundreds of billions of dollars wasted, a nation's psyche scarred, because JFK, his brother Robert Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, all continued along with McNamara, the real architect. And McNamara is, well, he would be like the Rumsfeld of today. Misguided, but one of our best and brightest, but completely wrong on the issues. Now imagine if we had had more enlightened people in positions who did not seek to support a political ideology, capitalism versus communism. Where would we be today? Well, today, Vietnam is actually thriving, and they are seeking to work with us. We have never once gone in to try to repair the damage done by the defoliant 245T. We have not addressed all of the hundreds of thousands of children born with deformities because of their exposure to the defoliant that we sprayed all over their country. We have made no major attempt to go in and remove all the landmines that we planted. But in spite of all that, they have managed to regain a sense of who they are as a people, and they're willing to extend a hand to cooperate with us. All that could have been avoided. Then we have Cambodia, and we have a man named Pol Pot, P-O-L-P-O-T. From 1955 to 1973, Prince Sihanouk was the leader of Cambodia. But he had a particular view that he was not supporting our Vietnam stance. He did not see that we were in the right by trying to control the South. And of course, the people we were supporting in the South were utterly corrupt. And also all the illegal heroin that was being shipped out of Vietnam through the Golden Triangle using CIA and Air America, the airline America, that the CIA fronted to get its heroin out. We were supporting warlords. We were supporting major dope dealers. And there was a lot of opposition to this. But the American public was not made aware of that. That would only happen years later. Well, what happened was that made him and the Cambodian people unpopular with our American government. So during the period of 1969 to 1977, the U.S. strafed Cambodia with carpet bombs, cluster bombs, phosphorus bombs, napalm bombs. These were against the Geneva Convention. These were acts of criminal activity. They were meant to weaken Prince Sihanouk's resolve. This attack left over 500,000 people dead, civilians, mainly women and children. Thousands more suffering from injury, disease, and a destroyed country. President Nixon and his advisor, Henry Kissinger, succeeded in ousting Prince Sihanouk in 1970 and placed in power Lon Nol. They supported Lon Nol and his government. Nol immediately sent military forces to Vietnam as part of his bargain. Unfortunately for them, Cambodians angry at Nol's military move supported the party of the Khmer Rouge, which eventually took power in 1975. Pol Pot, the leader of the Khmer Rouge, engineered the deaths of at least 1.8 million and as high as 2.5 million of his countrymen. In fact, it was nearly one half of all the people in Cambodia he personally engineered their death, one of the most heinous genocides in world history. And particularly interesting is his emphasis on killing people who were educated, people who were actually capable of doing things and thinking and reasoning and teaching and inspiring and motivating and leading. Those were the first to be shot. The rest were moved out of the city, including Phnom Penh, the capital, into the surrounding lands. The trouble is, there was no way of supporting these people's food needs. Many starved to death. Despite the fact that Pol Pot was forced to run to Thailand in 1979, the U.S. government secretly supported the Khmer Rouge. And the reason they continued to support the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot, even though he was a major genocidalist, he was a major killer? Simple. Because the Khmer Rouge were against the Vietnamese communists. So anyone who was our enemy and was we were attacking, if someone attacked them on our behalf, then they were our friends. Now put this in perspective. Saddam Hussein will probably be executed for causing the death of thousands, tens of thousands, possibly as many as 300,000 of his countrymen over a 23-year period. During all but the last 10 years of that, he did it on our watch with our full support. In effect, you could say that Saddam Hussein was our Pol Pot. And it was only after he invaded Kuwait, only after he refused to stop what he was doing, that we decided he was a liability. But when he was taking on the Iranians, he was our ally. Were we aware of the genocide? We were aware of the gassing of the Kurds and the Iranians? Absolutely. Were we aware that he was taking Shia and jailing them and disappearing them? Yes. Were we aware that his Sunnis, and through its Ba'athist political operations, were controlling virtually all of Iraq, yes, we were. But we chose to say nothing and do nothing, just like we chose to say nothing and do nothing about the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot except to support them. So if we are going to make an issue out of Saddam Hussein, why is it that we cannot make an issue out of all the other tyrants that we have supported? And is there a statute of limitations on committing genocide? The answer is no, there is not. In the world court, there is no time limit that you can escape genocide and the support of genocide. Then it is my view that we should have a very careful, thorough, honest, and objective investigations into the challenges that I am stating to bring all former or current individuals who participated through any agency of the United States government to trial for participating in acts against humanity. This comes from Scott Laufrey in Covert Action Quarterly on the issue of the U.S. and secret aid to Cambodia. Quote, the U.S. funneled $86 million in support of Pol Pot and his followers from 1980 to 1986. In addition, the Reagan administration schemed and plotted to have the Khmer Rouge representatives occupy Cambodia's UN seat, even though the Khmer Rouge government ceased to exist in 1979. This was a sad effort to grant Pol Pot's followers international legitimacy. That should not surprise anyone, as Reagan was a major architect of genocidal programs. Pol Pot died in 1989. Before he was brought to trial for his crimes against humanity. Later, the Khmer Rouge in Thailand, Vietnam, and Cambodia splintered and formed guerrilla groups that were allowed to flourish, especially in Cambodia refugee camps. Even Thailand and the U.S. forced the international relief organizations to nourish the starving Khmer Rouge along with the other suffering refugees. In an interesting twist, these guerrilla groups aided the new Prince Norodom Sihanouk in his bid against the standing Hun Sen government. Sihanouk's army was called the Sihanouk's National Army, and the Son Sann's militia was entitled the Khmer People National Liberation Front. The U.S. is accused of assisting both of these armies. They gave them arms, troops training, and aerial land intelligence as well. Was it known that these people were murderers who would kill and rape and plunder? Yes, it was. But they served some political ideological means. In 1982, the U.S. initiated a coalition of Asian nations, including China, the Associations of Southeastern Asian Nations, the newly ensconced Sihanouk, Son Sann, and the Prime Minister in the Khmer Rouge. This group was entitled the Government of Democratic Kampuchea. And the Khmer Rouge now has representatives at the UN through this group. Then there is Laos. It had gained complete independence from France in 1954, for which it had been struggling for 10 years. During the 16 years between the late 1950s and the early 70s, the CIA carried out systematic attempts to destroy the Communist Party in Laos, the Pathet Lao, because of its widespread influence on party politics. However, the Pathet Lao finally came to power in 1975 when it supplanted the King of Laos, who later died in prison. After North Vietnam entered Laos during the Vietnam War, author John Flam states, quote, the U.S. started bombing, dropping more bombs on Laos than the bombs dropped in World War II. Several million tons of cluster bombs were then used to totally destroy vast civilian districts in all three countries, Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. Districts simply crawling with subsistence farmers, unquote. So with malice aforethought and with complete intent, the United States military, in association with the State Department, the White House, members of Congress, and all the intelligence oversight and armed forces oversight committees, all of whom are equally responsible, Democrat and Republican, chose to kill hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians in Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. And of course, they lied about their intentions in Cambodia. Henry Kissinger lied. He said that there was no military incursions into Cambodia, and this is after we'd already been there, ran thousands of military operations and plane sorties in there, bombing and strafing civilian villages, all for naught. The Vietnam War also coincided with the secret flights of the CIA's Air America, an intelligence-owned airline that had become notorious later for its clandestine flights to take opium out of the region. Now let us go to Africa. I cannot, in the time permitting in this program, mention every country in Africa, but I will mention some of the more significant ones. Angola. American troops were sent to Angola in 1860, according to the U.S. State Department, to help install order among the natives and to safeguard American citizens, but the reality was it was to safeguard property. 115 years later, Americans intervened after Angola had received independence from their former Portuguese rulers in 1975. The people who were in power at the time would be considered left today. They were the popular movement for the liberation of Angola. They took charge of Angola. As a result, the U.S. immediately backed Jonas Savimbi's UNITA Army. That's the National Union for the Total Independence of Angola Army, when he instigated civil war against the ruling party. The U.S. used its situation to engage the Soviet Union in its Cold War struggle, using Angola as a battleground. The sitting Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, stated that the U.S. knew nothing about the conflict and only helped UNITA in response to a Soviet intrusion. Well, he is a liar. But then again, anyone who knows anything about him knows that he is a liar. The National Security Archive documents show the opposite to be true. The CIA was involved from the beginning, airlifting UNITA forces into the battle for Angola. Furthermore, John Stockwell, the CIA station chief of operations in Angola at the time, stated that America worked closely with the South African army, the apartheid army, the repressive army, who invaded Angola in support of UNITA forces. Quote, giving them our arms, coordinating battles with them, giving them fuel for their tanks and armored cars, unquote. The CIA was training the South African Army, quote, in the use of weapons and installing communication systems, unquote, while hiring white mercenaries to fight the black Angolans. Stockwell added that the U.S., quote, formed four little mercenary armies and delivered them into Angola to do their dirty business for the CIA, unquote. Well, hence the ruling party in Angola was forced to seek more military aid from Cuba and Russia in order to survive. The U.S. goal in the Angolan War was to draw the Soviet Union into a Vietnam War quagmire. The objective was achieved by the U.S. in the Afghanistan-Soviet War of the 1980s. Congress stopped funding the Angola War in 1976. However, this did not stop the CIA from secretly supporting it financially and with arms. The U.S. used Mobutu's Zaire to supply military bases and other support for UNITA. Well, George Bush Sr. was then the CIA director, and guess who was supporting all of these efforts? His lead man, Dick Cheney. And how was he doing this? He was supporting Jonas Savimbi, who was a murderer, while Donald Rumsfeld was a serious lobbyist for the restoration of congressional funds to the region, and President Reagan in 1984 restored open funding to the anti-government UNITA Army. Well, understand something. We were supporting terrorist organization, the Al-Qaeda of its era. They were murderers, rapists. They would kill, maim, and Jonas Savimbi would receive $50 million from Washington as of 1989. Men were drafted into his army by force. Women were used as sexual slaves to please the army, and farmers were forced to give up all their food to his guerrillas. In 1989, a peace negotiation formally removed Cuba and Soviet intervention from Angola. A major ceasefire in 1991 was violated after Savimbi's loss a 1992 UN-regulated election. Savimbi then couldn't get democratically elected. So he took his UNITA forces that George Bush Sr., that Dick Cheney, and that Donald Rumsfeld were supporting, and they immediately attacked cities all over the country. they destroyed much of Angola's provincial infrastructure in a campaign that would become known as the War of the Cities. The genocide would last from 1992 to 1994. It was considered a scorched earth military siege at Huambo for 55 days and an 8-month siege of Cuito, trapping 50,000 Angolans, mainly civilians, who had no way of getting food. And by 1993, there would be an average of 1,000 Angolan deaths per day. The death of Savimbi on February 22, 2002, at the hands of the Angola National Forces allowed for another tentative ceasefire. But understand something, and let us be very clear and unequivocal about this. 26-year-long terrorist war that the United States sanctioned and backed, causing 750,000 to 1 million people, two-thirds of them children, to die. In fact, because of the war, a child died, quote, of a preventable disease every 3 minutes, unquote. In addition, the United States caused 86,000 limbless victims who live now in Angola, courtesy of deceptive landmines that littered the country, placed primarily by George Bush Sr., Dick Cheney, and Rumsfeld's good friend, this total homicidal killing machine called Savimbi. Let us put it this way. He killed 3 times more people than Saddam Hussein. And yet, he was our friend and our supporter. All because we wanted to embarrass and humiliate the Russians, the games we play ideologically, and the cost to the people involved. But after all, why should the average American concern themselves, members of Congress, oversight committees? Everyone in Congress should have been fully aware of this. This shows racism. It was done on blacks in Africa. It hasn't seemed to concern them enough up to this point to demand an investigation and those responsible held liable for this genocide. Let us go to Chad, another place where we needed to bring peace, democracy, and freedom. In Chad, in 1981, the U.S. administration formally decided to supply Hissine Habré in his attempt to overthrow the government. Habré was supplied with money and arms and ammunition and other equipment by the CIA. Quote, the operation was coordinated with Egypt, which furnished Habré with weapons and ammunition in exchange for U.S. replacements, unquote. Sudan provided a supply line and a base of operations. Americans' commitment increased several times during 1981, ending with a total of $10 million to aid Habré's junta. Author William Blum writes that, quote, in June of 1982, Habré's men took control of the capital of Chad and set up a provincial government. Keep in mind, there was a government, but it didn't suit our needs. So we simply replaced it. Then let's take a look at the Democrat Republic of the Congo, which would then be called Zaire. On June 30, 1960, Congo became independent from its status as a colony of Belgium. Patrice Lumumba became the Congo's first prime minister. He called for political and economic liberation of Congo. He spoke against the past injustices of his people by the previous white colonial power. On July 11th, the Katanga province ceded. Katanga contained precious diamonds, cobalt, and copper, and maintained financial ties to Belgium. It also maintained links to prominent administration officials in the Eisenhower administration. Lumumba was dismissed by Congo's president in September 1960 at the behest of the U.S. government. Documents from a National Security Council meeting in August 1960 revealed that President Dwight Eisenhower personally commanded the CIA to assassinate Lumumba, who was murdered in January of 1961. Critics stressed that the reason for his murder was that he would not be reliable in suppressing the Congolese working class for the benefit of Western power and profitability. It was a warning to other African leaders to stay in line or get killed. Now, civil conflict and chaotic systems overtook the Congo. The Belgium and the United States forces intervened to help Katanga's secession, which elicited a firestorm of protests in many other African governments. The man who took charge of the Congo was Colonel Joseph Mobutu with the help of the CIA. Mobutu later changed his name to Mobutu Sese Seko, and the Congo was changed to Zaire in early 1970s in order to emphasize the African authenticity. Old film footage shows Lumumba being beaten to death in front of Mobutu and the UN troops all standing there. This is what happened. The country became extremely corrupt and repressive. Author Carol Collins wrote, quote, "Mobutu pillaged the public sector, harassing or jailing those who objected. In some years, he and his cronies siphoned 50% of Zaire's capital budget, as well as hundreds of millions in mineral export revenues, foreign aid and loans, and private investments, some guaranteed by Ex-Exim Bank, a U.S. company. The efforts were catastrophic. Despite vast mineral wealth, diamonds, cobalt, and copper, oil deposits, and immense hydroelectric and agricultural potential, Zaire's per capita income dropped to almost two-thirds of its original level since independence in 1960, and is now listed as the lowest of all 174 countries in the Human Development Report. It is estimated that between 1962 and 1991, the U.S. gave Mobutu close to $150 million just through the CIA and other secret transfers. The government collected more than $1.3 billion in development aid and $227 million in military assistance in return. Mobutu became one of the U.S.'s main Cold War allies in Africa. He was close friends with George Bush Sr. In fact, he was friends with the entire Bush family. The Congo was the staging base for CIA operations against communist-friendly African regimes such as Angola. And furthermore, the U.S. supported World Bank loans and International Monetary Fund credits to Mobutu's government, even though it was an open secret that Mobutu and his cronies stole all the money. The results were an almost $14 billion debt for Congo by the 1990s. This was followed by the World Bank's policy of privatization of Congo's national enterprises by many multinational corporations, which included U.S.-based companies. The stated goal was to repay the loans. Not true. Everyone at the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, everyone everywhere in government knew that if you sent money, he was going to steal it. He was repressing his people. There was no democracy, no freedom of speech. There was no dissent. So if we are really intending to give aid to countries to support freedom, democracy, and peace, why do we consistently give it to people who steal it, repress and kill and torture, and commit genocide? We even did it with Seychelles. Seychelles is a nation consisting of about 100 islands off the coast of Africa and the Indian Ocean. In 1977, France-Albert René, the leader of the Seychelles People's Progressive Front, came into power through a bloodless coup. And although René had a significant relationship with Western countries, he was a socialist. He wanted economic diversification. He wanted neutrality, and he wanted a nuclear-free Indian Ocean. Well, needless to say, that did not go well with Washington. So in 1979, they started an effort to destabilize Seychelles. And in November 1981, a mercenary army originating in South Africa invaded Seychelles in an attempt to provoke a coup against René's government. The attack failed with a confrontation ending at Seychelles Airport. The UN Security Council resolution wanted to condemn South Africa for their part in attempting to overthrow Albert René's government, but the U.S. intervened. Why? They wanted to hide South African involvement. A procession of South African trials uncovered the heinous coup, which had the backing of the full support of the CIA and America. Then we have Somalia. Somalia is in the news now. There was a general, Mohamed Saeed Barre. He became the leader of Somalia through a military coup in 1969. He was one of the most brutally repressive dictators ever in Africa. And he did not have any qualms about attacking Somalia's neighbors and citizens. Somalia dissidents and political opponents were arrested and tortured by the thousands. Furthermore, in the late 1980s, he waged war against rival coalitions of clans, and clans are an integral part of Somalia society. In 1990, Africa Watch reported that his aggression caused the death of between 50 to 60,000 people in just 2 years. At the beginning of his regime, he had strong backing of the Soviet Union, who supplied Somalia with military and economic aid. However, he invaded Ethiopia in 1977 against the Soviet Union, effectively ending their relationship. Well, who stepped in to help him? America. Now, mind you, you're talking about a man who is known to have killed 80,000 of his own citizens in just 2 years, who was ruthless in the extreme, a murderer, mass murderer. The United States gave him $100 million in aid. Despite his known ruthlessness, Washington considered him an ally. And he gave the U.S. a naval base, which allowed the U.S. access to the Gulf of Aden and the southernmost region of the Middle East. His penance for heavy-handed repression and war led to his removal in 1991 at the hand of rival clans, guerrilla forces. And Somalia would not have a centralized government after his downfall, although the U.N. tried to install one. And Somalia's society is controlled by groups of rival clans led by warlords with loose alliances between them. In 1992, 25,000 American troops entered Somalia under the Bush administration's humanitarian relief effort to help the UN provide food and to establish order in the famine-stricken country. Well, that's their point of view. Many historians argue the U.S. intervention was an attempt to reestablish the formidable conditions in Somalia that the U.S. enjoyed under that tyrant's regime. Author Steve Kurtzman wrote that before his downfall, he gave the U.S. oil companies concessions to approximately two-thirds of Somalian land. In the Clinton administration, which took power in 1993, U.S. troops were reduced as control was given to the U.N. forces. On October 3, 1993, members of the U.S. Delta Force, Navy SEALs, Air Force troops, and the Army Rangers attempted to apprehend the warlord in Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia. The covert operation failed, and it resulted in two U.S. Black Hawk helicopters being shot down, 18 U.S. soldiers killed, and caused the deaths of an estimated 1,000 Somalia guerrillas and civilians. After the fiasco, the Clinton administration pulled the last U.S. forces out of Somalia by March 1995. Early in 2006, there was an alleged U.S. operation attempting to suppress Islamic elements from taking power. Supposedly, we organized and supplied Somalia warlords in an effort to defuse the situation. The observations were made by Somalia's interim government officials and some American political analysts. Somalia warlords, with America's help and funding, created the Alliance for the Restoration of Peace and Counterterrorism to combat the growing predominance of fundamentalistic Islamic groups in Mogadishu. The Bush administration sees this Islamic group as a terrorist organization and associated with Al-Qaeda. However, at least one senior U.S. intelligence official stated that there are only a few Al-Qaeda members in Somalia and said they are primarily dysfunctional. The warlords are scorned by the average Somalian for their violent behavior. They rape women, they kill whoever they want, and they rob everyone, all as a means of controlling the population. Somalia Prime Minister Ali Mohamed Gedi called them criminals and characterized the Bush administration for not trying to work with the transitional government. The U.S. support for the warlords aroused anti-American animosity among the Somalia people. It also violated U.S. arms embargo against Somalia. The Islamic group in Mogadishu, while being fundamentalist in belief, established civic order in Somalia. They have these religious courts, schools, and hospitals. Battles broke out among the warlords and the Islamic groups in Mogadishu, and by June of 2006, about 300 Somalis died from the fighting, and Mogadishu was in the hands of an anti-Western Islamic leader who allegedly has ties to Al-Qaeda. Once again, we could have changed the situation. We did not. One of the most egregious acts by the United States is not challenging South Africa. On August 5, 1962, Nelson Mandela was captured by the South African Special Branch Police. He was imprisoned until February of 1990. Information about his identity and his whereabouts were given by whom? Our own CIA officer, Donald C. Rickard. That's right, an American turned in Nelson Mandela. America and South Africa had worked in their relationships despite the fact that South Africa brutally repressed its black majority through apartheid and engaged in frequent attacks against neighboring nations. Before Nelson Mandela became president through the African National Congress Party in 1994, the white South African government ruled by a military and police state. Through apartheid, blacks were separated from whites who were officially allowed access to 87% of the land. Blacks were only allowed into these areas with special government permissions called Book of Life passports. Despite a UN-mandated arms embargo and other sanctions against South Africa, including public efforts for U.S. corporate divestment from South African company, this divestment is you take your investments out of South Africa. The U.S. still quietly supported the apartheid regime. The Reagan administration was much more assertive in aiding South Africa during the first 3 years of Reagan's administration. U.S. arms sale to South Africa eclipsed the number of weapons we sold to South Africa in the previous 30 years under Ronald Reagan. And of course, we have our Libya, and that was a big mistake because where Colonel Gaddafi, who had ruled it since 1970, emphasized Libya's Arab nationalism governed through Islamic laws and socialist principles, but we didn't want that. So we started a conflict against him. And that was foolish because in the end, he supported terrorism and he supported the efforts against the United States. But there were so many times when we provoked other countries, mainly Egypt, to go in and attack Libya. But they didn't. But the Reagan administration in 1984 secretly supported France's covert attempt at assassinating Gaddafi. A CIA report was found which stated that Libyan military officers were vulnerable to being coerced into committing treason against Gaddafi. In 1985, the U.S. government created Operation Flower to oust Gaddafi by supporting Libyan exiles and by coordinating this and having a preemptive airstrike against Libya. In March 1986, three U.S. aircraft carriers situated themselves just 12 miles outside of Libyan border. The U.S. again claimed that the boats were in international water. The Reagan administration was no longer denying neutrality. They wanted Gaddafi out. It's amazing what we did. Had we taken a different approach, we could have kept Gaddafi from supporting terrorism. And then you have Morocco. There was a little tyrant. A real, real evil man. King Hassan II ruled Morocco from 1961 until his death in 1999. For 38 years, he was the epitome of a hedonistic and heartless aristocrat whose citizens lived in abject poverty. The U.S. had a very friendly relationship with his government. The U.S. had given Morocco the second greatest military and economic aid out of all African countries, Egypt being the number one recipient. And by the way, I'm not going to deal with Egypt today, but just take a look at how it treats its own citizens. A one-party system, no freedom of the press, no freedom of assembly, no freedoms at all, no democracy at all, yet it's our friend. A substantial amount of the money went directly to him personally. His personal fortune, $1.6 billion. Lifestyles, 20 palaces, villas, harems, 20% of the prime agricultural land he personally owned. And financially, the king had real estate all over the United States as well, secret offshore accounts, lots of drug money. Why? Because Morocco was known as a major cocaine trafficking center, and also they sold cannabis. 20 million Moroccans lived distinctly opposite lifestyles to their king. The most conservative estimate of Moroccan society put unemployment at 25%, poverty at 33%, illiteracy at 55%, and citizen access to sanitation and clean water 20%. Infant death in Morocco was the highest in North Africa under this president or this king. He kept his regime together through an iron grip and ruthless suppression of his opposition. Many incidents committed by his cronies were documented by Amnesty International, cases including arrest, imprisonment without due process, and gross abuses against political dissidents, including tortures and murders. There have been a half a dozen attempts to remove him from power. Far from condemning Morocco, the U.S. put him on the CIA payroll. The CIA was accused of giving him a videotape of a coup in progress against his government, which effectively saved him. In fact, the U.S., although officially neutral, supported him in his efforts to annex the phosphate-rich Western Sahara, despite the fact that he had no official claim on it, and it was completely unjustified. But he was our ally. He allowed the Reagan administration to use Morocco as an emergency airbase. He secretly channeled CIA funding to Jonas Savimbi's murderous army in the Angola War. He allowed Western companies into Morocco to exploit it for inexpensive mineral resources and cheap labor. And of course, we have Selassie and the last emperor in Africa. He was emperor of Ethiopia in the 20th century. Long regime. We intervened there constantly. But I'm looking at the time and we're getting close. So I want to go, time permitting, I'll come back to that, to Uganda. In January of 1971, Major General Idi Amin overthrew Milton Obote's elected Ugandan government. Amin would establish himself as one of Africa's most brutal dictators, killing over 300,000 Ugandans by the end of his regime. Amin was ruthless with friends and foes alike. Anyone who felt that they could be safe around him should think again. Despite his reckless brutality, he was anti-communist. Well, that put him in good standing with the U.S. and England. We gave Uganda aid and support, including CIA training for his military. Amin's continuous demand for more U.S. funding and advanced weapons eventually wore thin. The U.S. support wavered. 1978, Ugandan forces attacked Tanzania in Amin's bid to acquire the Kagera region, and the invasion failed. The Tanzanian army, working with Ugandan exiles, would force Amin to flee to Saudi Arabia in 1979. Political instability became the norm in Uganda, as ruling governments were often overthrown and replaced. In 1986, the current president of Uganda came to power as his National Resistance Army guerrilla forces took control of the country. The U.S. would once again consider Uganda an ally under this tyrant. He maintained power through corruption and rigorous control of the opposition parties in Uganda. He was involved in the Ugandan forces in the Democratic Republic of Congo Civil War, which is probably the most under-recognized war in the last century. Almost 4 million have died in that war. But the resources were there and support was there. And then look at Rwanda. In 1994... long-standing animosity between two socially defined ethnic groups, the Tutsis and the Hutus in Rwanda, created conditions where between 800 and 900,000 Tutsis and Hutu were murdered, mainly Tutsis. The conditions that led up to the slaughter included the murder of the president of Rwanda. The temporary government set up after the murder blamed the murder on Rwandese Patriotic Front, a Tutsi group, although this was disputed by many to be an inside job by the president's internal security detail. Amnesty International states, quote, the massacres were systematic, planned, and condoned at the highest levels of virtually all the levels. Virtually all the killers belonged to the majority Hutu ethnic groups, particularly the militia known locally as the attacked together. President Clinton and Madeleine Albright were, for their lack of action as the genocide proceeded, challenged. The Nation magazine editor David Korn pointed out that a National Security Archive report found, quote, throughout the crisis of genocide, considerable U.S. resources, diplomatic, intelligence, military, and sizable bureaucracies of the U.S. government were trained on Rwanda. This system collected and analyzed information, sent it to the decision makers so that all options could be properly considered and on the table. Indeed, the story of Rwanda for the U.S. is that officials knew so much but still decided against taking action or leading other nations to prevent or stop the genocide. Despite Rwanda's low ranking and importance to the U.S. interests, President Clinton administration officials had tremendous capacity to be informed and were informed, but the slaughter continued, unquote. Author William Ferro-Giraro gathered copies of the classified National Intelligence Daily documents from 1994, which clearly revealed that Washington was fully aware of the genocide taking place. The April 26 edition of NIA, or NID, stated that, quote, the Red Cross estimates that 500,000 people, mostly Tutsi, have been killed in the ethnic bloodletting thus far. At the end of the day, President Bill Clinton, Madeleine Albright, all of the people in his administration and the top people at the State Department and everyone else who was brought in on these briefings, made fully aware, decided to do nothing. Why? We will never know the truth. We can only suggest that they were not of strategic importance. So one of the most horrific genocides in history had occurred. Nearly 900,000 people killed in 90 days, 3 months, while America did not intercede for peace, democracy, freedom, to stop the killing. That's one of the times when we should have, and we did not. I'm Gary Nall. This brings us up to part four, ending of our intervene series. I will have one more in this program, focusing upon Europe. And the next time someone tells you in the media or the administration or one member or other of the House or Senate why we need to be in a place, understand that there's another side to that story. Thank you for listening.